This is the ongoing story of a loving wife and mother of three, who seemingly vanished into thin air on New Year's Day. A wife who stood by her husband through good and bad, and a wife who would eventually become victim to the evil within that relationship. This is the story of Anna Walsh and the ongoing search for justice. This is Finding Anna.
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts just to not miss any breaking updates on this case and conversations as we have them. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Was it all about the money? As we learn more and more about the dark, grotesque, I don't even know if there's a word for it after reading through his search history, Brian Walsh's search history yesterday, just a deplorable human being. What was his motive? That's the question a lot of people are trying to figure out. Was it just an unhappy marriage and this was his way out? Or did something tick over in his mind from divorce ideas? Because we know he searched that for a while, to literally murdering his wife, allegedly. Where did that change? What was the thing that made it go from, I'm unhappy, let's get a divorce, to, I think I'm going to kill you and profit off of it? Two interesting pieces of evidence that we have here for you today. And we're going to be talking a little bit later in the show with the former FBI special agent, Stuart Kaplan. We're going to talk about the way that these people operate and how they hide among us, and maybe some things to look out for in our own relationships, in our own lives. But let's go to this evidence first. And this is one of the things that we dug deeper into after reading the list of horrendous things he searched for online after she was essentially murdered. We don't have a body, but the search history, if you're not familiar with it, listen to yesterday's episode and you can go through all of that. Basically searching for ways to dispose of a body in about 50 different search terms. One of those, though, at 6:25 a.m. one of the days, was how long for someone to be missing to inherit. Everything else was about how to dispose of a body, how to cut up a body, how to make a body disintegrate in chemicals, all sorts of horrible things. But there's the one in there where it goes through his stream of consciousness of, I want to get that money. How long for someone to be missing to inherit? So it seems from that he had the thought process of, oh, she'll just be missing. I'll be the grieving husband. He had this all planned out, so much so that he was making notes about how to handle this when people ask questions. The Daily Mail noticed in one of the pictures that was taken within his home, inside the Walsh home, there was a note on the counter and it says, response to friends. I appreciate your concern. Right now, my focus is on finding Anna and spending time with, and I'm assuming it goes into talking about the children, but we can't read much more in the case. What that kind of tells me is this is a person that doesn't know emotionally how to respond to anything. And if you look at his past, which is a whole other story, this is a person who just does whatever he feels and pleases at that moment without seeming regard to others' emotions, feelings, what's right and what's wrong. And when a person is missing that part of their psyche, they're capable of doing absolutely horrible things. But in order to blend in, they need notes. They need to take cues from other people. It's essentially faking it until you make it. And they can do it pretty well for a while, but then things tend to go off the rails. Psychopath, sociopath, narcissist. We're going to talk about all that in just a little bit. And the differences between them, because it's easy to apply labels. And at the end of the day, a label is a label. He still very likely did these horrible things to his wife and to his children as well. He took away their mom, if he is in fact the killer, which obviously things look pretty much like it's going that direction. Back over to the inheritance, now that we established a little bit more about the psyche of this individual, And some of you are probably already well aware of all those things. So forgive me if I'm repeating information that you're already aware of. There's a lot of folks who are just new to this story and are trying to catch up a bit. Anna and her real estate, she had quite a bit, almost $3 million in real estate property. She was connected to 8 properties in D.C., Maryland, and Massachusetts. And she was the general manager for Tishman Speyer, a commercial real estate firm. She's sold many properties since 2018, still owns several of them. And like I said, valued around $3 million. So was that, if they're still married, which they were, and if she goes missing or disappears, as he put it, how long till he gets that money? How long till he's in control of those properties and can profit off of them as the wife is just simply missing? Why do we think that he was going for just simply missing? Because he did all those searches of how to literally destroy a body where you can't find a body. What does formaldehyde do? Can you throw away body parts? So many things. Hacksaw, best tool to dismember. He's going for the, you're never going to find her body because it's literally been destroyed approach. But how does that all play out? How does it all play out if there is no body? Is a body needed? Is that something that's difficult when it comes to prosecuting a case against someone charged with murder for their spouse? Saw an interesting article on this the other day, and I'm going to quote it about that very specific issue. This is a criminal defense attorney, Duncan Levin, speaking, and they say, without the body, the case is not a slam dunk for the prosecution. If they find her body, the case will obviously become much more difficult for the defense to have a fighting chance, but it's not a slam dunk. As easy as it is for us to be out here in the ether Monday morning quarterbacking the whole thing and going, oh my gosh, this is pretty damning evidence. And it certainly is. Without the body, it does make it a little more difficult. But at the same point, Brian Walsh made it a lot more easy to prosecute him without actually having the body on hand. With the amount of things he was doing, the premeditation, the searches, the knife in the house, the blood in the house, the back of his car, the tarps. I mean, it's pretty much, if you want to get caught, he did everything he could to get caught. However, I don't think his goal was to get caught. In my opinion, he's either a psychopath, a narcissist, or sociopath. Narcissist certainly is part of that. We're going to talk about the three differences and how this plays into his personality in just a few moments, which essentially is the guidebook for how he's going to act, how he has acted in the past with other interactions, why he was on house arrest at the time of all of this. How did he get there? What did he do? Who did he screw over without regard, it seems? And that's the scary thing. When you have someone in your own home who's capable of doing things that almost seem impossible unless you simply don't have a conscience or have that part of you that says, this is not okay. This is not good. What do you do? If you love somebody, you care about them, you don't want to just run away and hope for the best for them, because a lot of times when you're in those situations, you feel like you're the only person that's going to keep that person from digging themselves into a very dark hole of trouble. But at the same point, if you stay there and keep trying to be that barrier between them and the outside world and what they could possibly get themselves into, you yourself are going to find yourself in a very, very dangerous situation, which unfortunately and sometimes leads to death, which appears to have happened here in this case. On that note, former FBI Special Agent Stuart Kaplan joining us to speak on that. When you look at Brian Walsh, you know, I get slimy and slick, specifically from his art dealings and some of his other dealings in the past. But, you know, if you were in that situation or I was in that situation and this is your spouse, I don't get murderer. But I suppose if one thing is possible for them to go down and really create damage and chaos in others' lives, maybe there really is no limit to what some of these individuals are capable of doing.
and you look at him, and even though he may have a stellar past with respect to being a convicted felon and maybe being a fraudster, he doesn't measure up to what someone would think looks like a murderer. Mm-hmm. But if you look or heard the evidence that they have collected in connection with what he is accused of doing, he's a monster. And so he doesn't look like a monster. He looks like a normal person. And that's what I remind your listening audience of.
While we look at them and go, they seem a little abnormal here and there, but in their minds and in their actions, they never contemplate that. They seem to think they are normal, which allows them then to carry out such absurd crimes with, when we're talking about Walsh, the art fraud of literally stealing Warhols from his friend and reselling them, and then going a step further and selling fraudulent Warhols. And there was many other things with him, stealing $1 million from his father, $100,000 pilfered from the inheritance that he wasn't supposed to be getting. They're able to do these things with such ease. Is it because there is nothing in their brain saying, this isn't right, this is a bad idea?
I think when you look at, for example, this guy, Brian Walsh, again, a highly intelligent individual who just has gone about his life with such impunity. And even, you know, with respect to being convicted and being charged and being accused of basically being a fraudster, that in no way seemed to have dissuaded him from continuing his way of life. Mm-hmm. But the scary part or the interesting part about him is there's such a separation or such a gap between the behavior of quote unquote a fraudster, someone who just has larceny in their blood, who may, you know, tend to want to steal or defraud people. There, that you know, that's one type of person, you know, someone who has the impulsiveness or the tendency to be such a violent person, to then get to the point where they can not only kill someone, but also then take it upon themselves to dismember their loved one, their closest person, their wife, to kill them and dismember them and then discard them literally in garbage bags and throw them into a dumpster. That's a monster. That's an evil person. The problem that I have is, where were the signs going back to his behavior of being a fraudster? Mm-hmm. Were there any signs of this potential explosive, violent, evil person? Or was it such a suppressed manifestation of something that happened early on in his childhood? And it was just a matter of time until it got to the point where either this poor woman had decided that she was going to reveal him or expose him to his dastardly deeds, whatever he recently had done. Mm-hmm. And then he decided that the only way to deal with her, you know, instead of divorcing my wife, I'm going to kill her, and not only kill her, but dismember her. Yeah. I mean, that's a sicko. That's a whacked person. And so, again, it's just confusing to all of us because we live our lives in this, you know, believable, you know, feeling that a monster, an evil person looks like something, mm-hmm. and it really doesn't.
Yeah, I completely, and that's how a lot of people look at any sort of extreme behavior. A lot of times, for example, if an alcoholic, they must be sitting on the curb with a bottle and a bag, right. and it's like, no, it's actually your boss who's down the hall there that's leading a very productive life. It's usually where you least expect it. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about some of the signs that people would see, and what actually can be done, because that comes to mind a lot, especially with the Koberger case. It's coming to mind with Anna as well. There had to have been things, and this is in no way trying to blame a victim. It's more so trying to identify what traits are out there that others down the road here can kind of look out for, can kind of see, and maybe take a little more serious than just, oh, they have some trouble, or oh, they're acting weird, or they're antisocial. In Koberger's case, we heard a report the other day of when the father had dropped him off at college, his father went to the neighbor that of in the apartment saying, hey, you know, my son lives over here. We're talking about a 28-year-old man, but the father is still saying, hey, you know, doesn't have many friends, you know, maybe could you be his friend? to an adult child, about an adult child, essentially. There obviously was something there that he knew that his son was a bit off, probably nowhere near to the extent that his son could do things like this. Is that true, that he just really wouldn't have known that his son is capable of this? Or sometimes when you're a father or a parent or a spouse to one of these people, are you too close to really even tell?
So to that point, and it's a great topic to talk about, because every investigation that I was ever involved in, and even after my bureau career, and just, you know, coming on as an expert in all the active shooter or mass shooting cases, there is one common denominator. And that is that some of the closest people to these individuals had some sort of inkling, some sort of indication that this person's behavior was either rock bottom or changing, or just, you know, very fluidly, they were living a life of isolation. They didn't have friends. They didn't have close social relationships. And so when you look at a common denominator, and especially in mass shooting type of situations, where just, you know, out of nowhere, a person who we've never heard of, maybe even a person who's never been on the radar, gets up one day, you know, loads up his, you know, his AK-47 or his AR-15 and gets into the car and decides that he's going to start shooting up the place and killing people. Everybody says, from the outside looking in, this was the perfect person. But yet, as the investigation unfolds, all of a sudden you hear from the closest people, you know, either the mom or the dad or the sister or the brother or, you know, someone in the neighborhood who said that it was interesting. I noticed that the person was tending to live his life in isolation. He tended to mind his own business. He didn't really interact in normal social circles. And so that is a consistent underlying factor that I think is something that we as a society need to address and look at, because it's certainly indicative of people carrying out horrendous acts. And so when you talk about Brian Koberger, how is it possible that someone in their, you know, mid or late 20s who's going to college or going to graduate school would not, in the normal course of going to college — one of the best things about going to college or going to graduate school is the social aspect, right? Because after going to school, you get together with your friends or your girlfriends, and you go to a bar, or you go to a drinking hole, or you play sports, or you go to sports, or whatever you do. You know, part of that is the is what we want to experience in our college days or in graduate days. It's not all about just classroom work. And so it's interesting when you hear about the father who's kind of knocking on neighbors' doors to almost solicit them to reach out to Brian Koberg to see if they can enlist making friends with him. That's a red flag.
Yeah.
So that's a wrong, you know, just a unfortunate situation. And, you know, it's something we should pay more attention to.
And that, I think, is the big question of paying more attention to. I want to address one thing before we continue there, because you said earlier, if someone sees those signs online, make a report so it's there. And something that I think many will argue, go, why? Nothing's going to happen anyhow. But the real reality of that is then it's on record. So if he does get picked up for something, or she gets picked up for something else down the road, or another report comes in, then there's a record. And it's, you're not just the first person to say something, which is more likely to get brushed off or to be put aside because there's not a record. Is that correct?
100%. And let me just go one step further.
Yeah.
You know, more recently, and I would say probably in, let's just say, the last 5 years, I will take my hat off. Local and state and federal law enforcement has literally been working so much better together in sharing information, not only upwards, but also downwards. And by saying that, it is so important to contact local law enforcement. Why? Because oftentimes, if nothing is reported and the FBI is working a case on, you know, maybe, you know, someone who they're trying to identify as perhaps being a serial killer, it, you know, they'll go and tap into the local resources to see if there's any profile of any individual who has a report on him or her with respect to stalking, harassing, or attempting to kidnap or something of that sort. And so that's why I urge everybody that it is so important to document these encounters, because whether the locals are going to work with the state or the state is going to work with the feds or vice versa, this information can be so pivotal so probative and so important in apprehension of identifying and apprehending a potential suspect in solving a case before it becomes a murder case. That's why I urge everybody, if you see something, and I know it sounds very cliche, mm-hmm. you know, if you see something, say something, you know, and I guess we're all getting tired of hearing that, but there's a lot of truth to that.
There really is. It's just a matter of having, I think, sometimes the strength to speak up and the confidence to be able to get out of those sort of situations in a safe manner. Stuart Kaplan, former FBI special agent, thank you for joining us and giving some of your insights to us on this case. So I talked about it earlier a little bit. Similarities, differences between sociopath, narcissist, and a psychopath. And we're going to take a deeper dive into this in a future episode. We're like almost going to do a lesson on it, so we can all kind of get up to date, get up to speed, and have a better understanding of what these terms mean. Because it's very easy to throw them out there. Oh, they're a psychopath. Oh, they're a narcissist. Or they're a sociopath. Having a better understanding of what you're dealing with can also help you understand where they may be going, what you may be able to predict of their actions in the future. Narcissist, that's a much more common one than sociopath and psychopath. But here's the deal. All of them share a lot of similar characteristics. A narcissist is a product of low self-esteem. This is someone in an endless need for validation and acceptance. It may not always seem like that on the surface because they seem to have this aura of confidence, which this man does, but it's all stemming from not having a very positive view of oneself or their self-worth. Now, a narcissist and all of these, sociopath, psychopath, they all share these, okay? Egocentric, charismatic, confident, manipulative, antagonistic, entitled. Psychopath, sociopath, narcissist, that's what they all share together. Now, a narcissist is usually the baseline for what else could be going on there. And that can stem off into sociopathic behavior, psychopathic behavior. We're going into the sociopath route, and let's talk about those individuals for a moment. They can experience fear and remorse, but a sociopath is a product of brutality, trauma. It suppressed fear and remorse as a survival mechanism. Poor impulse control and all those things we just talked about, egocentric, charismatic, confident, manipulative, antagonistic, entitled. But because of that trauma and that fear, that utter fear that they have very deep within them and remorse as a survival mechanism, they're able to do things and not necessarily feel it in the moment, but can feel it sometimes afterwards. That's where you get the fear and remorse sometimes in a sociopath. A psychopath, although close in the family tree here and sharing the egocentric, charismatic, confident, manipulative, antagonistic, entitled features, they're the more grandiose, imposing, and pretentious type. They're product biology. Fearless, remorseless, and calculated. If you look at brain scans of individuals who've been diagnosed as psychopaths, they're very different than others, than what you'd say a healthy individual. There's differences between them and a narcissist and a sociopath. The psychopath is the scariest of all of them because of that fearlessness, that remorselessness, the calculated characteristics of what they're doing. Egocentric, charismatic, confident, manipulative, antagonistic, entitled, poor impulse control, grandiose, imposing, and pretentious. If I were to make a guess, psychopath is what I would say about this individual. I'm not a doctor. I can't diagnose someone this far away. But a lot of things with Brian Walsh are not that hard to call out because I don't see there being any remorse here. I don't see there being any fear in him or doing any of this as a survival mechanism. I do wonder how calculated or how long this was calculated for, or if this was a product of impulse control, considering the night of New Year's Eve, they had a friend over that said there was absolutely nothing amiss. It seemed like a normal evening and they had a good time ringing in the new year. And by morning, Brian's searching on the internet for ways to dispose of a body. In fact, I don't think she made it very long into the new year whatsoever, because literally 4:55 a.m., how long before a body starts to smell on January 1st is what he's searching. So I'm assuming there's a body if he's searching that at that point. How to stop a body from decomposing, how to embalm a body, 10 ways to dispose of a dead body if you really need to. 10 ways to dispose of a body. That's interesting because the internet is full of lists. The fact that that is even out there as a list is rather disturbing. And just 5 searches in, how long for someone to be missing to inherit? Is that our possible motive here? That's the question that we're asking as of right now. This is such a heartbreaking story, especially for those 3 kids who not only lost their mother, but, well, it's probably a good thing their father's not going to be in the picture anymore, because I can't imagine anything good would come of him being an influence of any type on those young lives. That's the latest that we have for you today. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our episodes, discussions, and breaking updates here on Finding Anna. You can get an ad-free experience on Apple Podcasts right now as well. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. I'm Tony Bruschi. For all of us at True Crime Today and Finding Anna, thanks for listening.